You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. It's so lovely to see you all here. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation in partnership with the Los Angeles Public Library. When we think of libraries, we think of a community and a place full of books. But as we move into the digital age, a library no longer has walls, although it still remains a center for dissemination of ideas and a place for everyone to gather. Now, all of its bounty is accessible across borders and oceans. It has always been a democratic hub, but in the 21st century, the wealth of knowledge is at everyone's fingertips. Become a member tonight. You will be supporting our outreach programs like the first online accredited high school degree in the nation and serving underprivileged children and teens with free books, free Wi-Fi, computer access, and classes. You'll have first dibs to programs like this and much more. Now, for the program. Tonight, we welcome Michael Pollan and Lara Boroditsky. Michael Pollan has been an iconoclast, one of the major thinkers who has changed the way we perceive the fundamentals of human existence, most importantly, how food interacts with our environment. In doing so, he questions the tenets of our lives and makes us look at things newly, challenging the way we're living. He explores our relationship to nature, how we cook food, think about it, consume it, the pleasure of it, and how we grow and absorb it. He's an activist causing us to question our previous assumptions. He has published 7 books on the issues. In his most recent book, How to Change Our Mind, he gives us a firsthand scientific account of what psychedelics can teach us about ourselves, the basics of what it is to be truly alive. Michael Pollan has won numerous awards, including Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World. He teaches journalism at both Harvard University and UC Berkeley School of Journalism. He'll be in conversation with cognitive scientist Lara Boroditsky, whose work focuses on linguistic relativity and abstract thought. She's interested in how people locate themselves in the world through the concept of time, how we create meaning and use knowledge. She has published numerous articles in prestigious journals on these topics. Boroditsky teaches at the University of California at San Diego. Please help me welcome these two extraordinary people, Michael Pollan and Lara Boroditsky. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh, what a pleasure to be able to have this conversation with you here. Is it coming on yet?
What? Is it coming on yet? Yeah. So, we were talking about this backstage. You have a book, right, in your hands, and it's signed, right? I used a very special ink.
So, it's an extraordinary book, such a pleasure to read, and reading it, I was just intensely jealous that someone could write such a book. But I kept it, please. But I have to confess, I kept wanting to stop reading the book because I wanted to go and do drugs. Instead, you made it sound so fun. Is this a reaction to a lot of other
Yeah, here? This is, I haven't seen any statistics on consumption of psychedelics in the last year. But a lot of people had that reaction. And I think that, I've heard from a lot of people who were inspired to do things they had never done before, mm-hmm. or to pick up on activities they hadn't done for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And it always makes me feel a little funny. I mean, I feel kind of responsible if something goes wrong. You know, these are risky drugs. Things do go wrong.
Maybe you could say a couple of things about the risks.
I think the book has been generally perceived as pretty enthusiastic about psychedelics. But I was a very reluctant psychonaut, you know, myself, and I had I approached them with a lot of trepidation and fear. I hadn't used them when I was young, at the age-appropriate stage of life. because I just didn't think I was sturdy enough to withstand this assault. And also just kind of, I came of age that the moment at which this would enter into the realm of possibility was just when the backlash, this moral panic was setting in. This is in the late 60s. And you were hearing these horrible stories about, you know, Art Linkletter's daughter jumped out of a window on LSD, maybe true, maybe not true. Kids staring at the sun till they went blind, not true. No, completely made up.
That definitely not a good idea to stare at the sun, though.
What?
Definitely not a good idea to stare at the sun, though.
No, don't. Yeah. I don't want to plant that suggestion.
PSA.
Yeah. No, actually, that rumor, which spread across the country, it was traced to the Commissioner of the Blind in the state of Washington, who was very worried about college kids using LSD and thought that story would really discourage them, mm-hmm. even though he'd made it up. Mm-hmm. He was discredited. But there were all these, you know, really scary stories about, and it would scramble your chromosomes, so I was just too afraid. And then when I got into it later, I felt I had to assure myself. I mean, when you start psychedelics at 60, you know, you have a cardiologist. And so I went to him and I said, look, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? And he said, well, the only one I would stay off of is MDMA. What? I don't, you know, he said, well, because it can raise your heart rate. And anyway, it turns out not to be an issue, but but there, so I did my due diligence, mm-hmm. looking at the risk, and what I found was kind of amazing. I mean, physiologically, the risks are very low. These are, and I'm talking about here psilocybin and LSD and DMT, this would apply to, that they're non-toxic, in the sense that there is no known lethal dose. You can't overdose. I mean, you can get very fucked up, but you can't overdose in such a way that your heart will, you know, shut down or your autonomic nervous system will stop working. And that's incredible because you have drugs in your medicine cabinet that have a lethal dose, and it's measured in 15, 20 pills. And then they're non-addictive, too. If you do that setup with the rats where you give them the choice of pulling a lever for food or drugs, and with cocaine they'll do it, or heroin they'll do it till they die. With LSD they'll do it once. they will not go back to that. But there are risks, and the risks are practical. You can do something really stupid. You can walk out into traffic. Your judgment is impaired. And there are psychological risks. There are definitely people who should stay away from these drugs. I mean, people at risk for schizophrenia in particular, bipolar, people on certain psychiatric drugs should not take them. So it's not like cannabis. I think people have to be a lot more thoughtful and mm-hmm. Deliberate about it.
So I think one of the risks of taking these drugs is then you'll go around telling people about your trips. and then everyone has to hear about your trips. And yeah. I have to say, when I was first starting to read your book, I came from a generation that the ethic was definitely no one wants to hear about your
right.
trips. So as I entered the book, I thought, oh God, now I'm going to have to read about this guy's trips. You know, why can't you be polite and keep it to yourself? But I was so, you're such a beautiful writer, and you really bring these experiences to life so vividly. And yet, even given that, you struggle against this ineffability that yeah. psychedelic experiences have, that it's really hard to put them into words. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about that and the struggle, especially for someone who's so used to having this command of language. I mean, this is your whole craft.
It was, I approached that as the greatest challenge I had faced as a writer, because I had read a lot of trip reports that were incredibly boring. I mean, it is like when people want to tell you their dreams.
Yeah.
And how
tell
often...
Tell me more.
Yeah. and I didn't know how I was going to do it, because the many things about the experience, yes, they're ineffable, defy words. But they're also on this weird kind of frontier between the profound and the banal. And, you know, one of the big insights people have on psychedelics is that love is the most important principle in the universe. Now, that's true, but it's also the kind of sentiment you would find on a Hallmark card. And so how do you write about that with conviction? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure how I was going to do that. And I approached that chapter, there's kind of one chapter where I do most of the trips, not all of them, with, you know, a lot of, as much trepidation as I faced the actual taking of the drugs. And you know, there are many ways to do it. I didn't want to write about it ironically because it wasn't an ironic experience. It was yeah. It was one of the most meaningful experiences of my life. And so there, you know, there's always cheap irony that you can use. And yet, when I wrote about it really straight, it was just seemed really over the top. And so I went back and forth for a while. And then I gradually found that the way to write about it, for me, was to kind of break the fourth wall mm-hmm. at various points and turn to the audience and say, I know how crazy this sounds, or let's talk about this problem with love. Mm-hmm. And just kind of had it out and just was very open about the challenges of describing it. And it's funny, this and this technique, if you want to call it that, I kind of learned from reading memoirs, and I was teaching a course on memoirs and writing personal essays, and I realized that the really great memoirs moved in and out between, say, the five-year-old's consciousness and the adult consciousness recollecting it, mm-hmm. or the 15-year-old's and the 60-year-old's, whatever it is. And it was the tension, you know, going back and forth between those two ways. If you stayed in the child's consciousness, I mean, it might be an interesting literary thing, but it wouldn't really be a memoir. It wouldn't be bringing perspective as well as evocation to the same thing. So I found if I use that, and instead of going back and forth in time, I was going back and forth in perspective, my straight self, my tripping self. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to work, and I got comfortable doing it that way. And in the end, those passages were absolutely the most fun I've ever had as a writer. Mm-hmm. I was just saying to somebody backstage, normally as a journalist, you're working in this tight box of checkable facts. Mm-hmm. And here I was like, I was writing about the pure products of my imagination, mm-hmm. I guess it was. I don't know what it was the pure products of. That's part of the mystery. And it turned out to be great fun. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad people like the trip accounts. That gratifies me more than just about anything. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, the fact that you haven't laughed the science in the book out of out of the court is pretty thrilling too.
So I'm curious a little bit more about the ineffability. Do you think it's just that we haven't had enough experience, and so we haven't developed a vocabulary or a way of talking about it? And could we F the ineffable at some point?
Yeah, that's what I titled that essay. I wrote an essay about writing about this in the book review that came out around Christmas, and I titled it F-ing the ineffable. Mm-hmm. But they thought that had a double entendre. I don't know. I don't know what they were thinking.
They were tripping.
I think it's, you know, one of the researchers put it to me like this. I was talking to him about ineffability, and he said, well, it's as if a caveman came to our world, mm-hmm. and he saw cell phones and airplanes overhead and speeding trains, and he would just say it was big and loud, but he wouldn't have words for these mm-hmm. things. And he thought we were kind of in that boat. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to that. I mean, you're also dealing with, like, it's very pre-linguistic. I mean, it's you're dealing with very unprocessed mental material too. I mean, who knows where it comes from? But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, there's some things that give themselves more easily to language than others. So Wittgenstein gives this wonderful example. He says, if I ask you, what's the height of Mount Kilimanjaro? That's a question you can answer in language, provided you know the answer. It's easy to give a precise answer. But if I ask you, what does a clarinet sound like? Mm. unless you've already heard a clarinet, I'm not really going to give you a very useful description.
Right.
And so there are lots of things in our normal conscious experience that are also hard to put in language. The languages differ in which kinds of things are better and worse at describing. So, for example, English is not very good at smells. We don't have a good vocabulary for smells, but other languages have better vocabularies.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, in the societies that have traditionally used psychedelics.
Yeah, that would be very interesting to study. Mm-hmm. I mean, you do have these cultures that have been using them continually for hundreds of years, and whether they have a better vocabulary. Because they are new to the West. You know, they really burst on the scene in the 1950s. And we're still processing them, I think, as a culture. We're still figuring out what they're good for and how, I mean, that's what all the scientific research is about, in a way. What's the best way to use them? Mm-hmm. You know, should you be listening to music? Should you be outside? Should you be wearing eye shades? We're trying to create a cultural form for this very raw power. And it's interesting that these other cultures, I mean, and I think we have a lot to learn from the cultures that have been using them for a long time. And they have, there's certain things in common. They tended not to use them alone. Mm-hmm. They tended to use them in a very ceremonial way, with this reverence for the power of these psychedelics. There was always an elder involved. I think that was really important, that people didn't do this on their own, kind of freelancing. Mm-hmm. And they always did it with an intention. They were healing, they were contacting the dead, whatever it was, there was an intention. And I think, you know, we need to take that to heart. I think it's, because I think when we started using them, we didn't know what, you know, I mean, they didn't have an instruction manual, and people used them in many different ways, and some ways turned out to be wonderful, and some ways turned out to be, like putting it in the punch bowl, I think that's not such a good idea. But there was a lot of that in the 60s. You know, it's strikes me as, you know, cruel and dangerous. Apparently you couldn't go near the Grateful Dead's dressing room without getting spiked, even if you were, like, carrying a big camera on your back, you were making a film, whatever. I mean, the doorknob had LSD on it, the fruit all had LSD on it, and they thought this was, you know, they were a service to humanity.
When I hear you say we don't know what the best way of using these substances is, I'm wondering if there is a best way, or if there are lots of different
ways.
There's
not one best way. Yeah. No, I think that, yeah, it's context dependent. So we're developing a medical model, and that's very promising, right? A way to use it which involves a guided experience with two therapists, typically a man and a woman, who prepare you very carefully, tell you what to expect, give you a set of flight instructions in case anything scary happens, and then they sit with you during the thing. You're never unattended. And then afterward, they have an integration session where they help you make sense of what happened. Mm-hmm. And that protocol, which was really invented in the 50s, and has certain shamanic influences, actually, is proving to be effective in the treatment of several different indications. But that's a medical model. That's for people who have mental illness.
It doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
It can be. And then there is the religious model, which has really descended from the shamanic traditions. You have the ayahuasca churches, which are legal in this country. They can use ayahuasca. And then you have the Native American church, which uses peyote. And that is also effective in a different way for other things. Mm-hmm. What we don't have, or the area where we're still kind of grappling, is between those two poles of religion and science, or religion and medicine. And that, because as person in the book who we both know, Bob Jesse, said that, you know, he's interested also not just in the ill, but the betterment of well people. Mm-hmm. And so how do the rest of us use these drugs? Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, I think we're still working on that. I think that the model of the guide I found really effective. I mean, I talked to people who had a lot of experience with psychedelics, and I described the system where you're, this protocol where you're lying down, you're wearing eye shades, and you're listening to music on headphones, a playlist that's been pretty carefully curated by the, you know, the guide. And they go, oh, no, I want to be outside. I want to be at the beach. I want to be in the woods. Eye shades. And they're really offended by the concept. And I get that, because I had a very powerful experience in my garden that I described in the book. But those eye shades turn out to be this very powerful technology. They send you inside. I mean, your eyes are... I mean, you know this better than most people, but your brain will make up for any absences, right? You take away vision, and it will start generating visual imagery. And so
you could say the same thing for audition, right? And yet the protocol here says you should flood yourself with sound, but you should isolate vision. You could imagine doing exactly the reverse.
The opposite, right? Yeah, make
or
absolutely
smell
soundless.
Or touch.
You could. The reason they do music for a couple of reasons, as I understand it. One is to block out extraneous noise. Mm-hmm. They're really trying to remove you from your immediate environment. Mm-hmm. Because the classic acid trip is, you know, something that is lots of stimulation coming at you. You're at a concert, you're mm-hmm. at the beach, or whatever, lots of people around. And it's about the distortion of that sensory information that is a lot of what the experience is about. They want a more of a blank slate, so you go inside, and you know, so if you're a cancer patient, you go into your body and you visit your cancer, and they want to free your mind from the anchors of reality, so you can really bring lots of mental material into this observable space. The music, though, also does. And this is kind of weird scientifically, because you're introducing this powerful variable. But the music has an incredible power on psychedelics. I mean, I'm not the first to say that. But when you don't have anything coming into your eyes, you start seeing the music. Mm-hmm. And there's this synesthesia. And every note is a thing. It's mm-hmm. palpable. And that I found that incredibly powerful. I'm not... By nature, that music's not a giant part of my life, but it was for the duration of some of these experiences.
I was really interested, as you went through the book, the metaphors that you had for the psychedelic experience and how they changed. So you start out with the trip or a journey, and that metaphor, of course, gets extended in popular culture. So people might warn that a trip might not be a round trip.
Right.
Right.
Well,
you take that.
That was a headline in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. But then from there you go onto expansion or an increase in entropy. And it seems like that still isn't the final metaphor, and there could be many, many others.
Yeah.
So you could think of it as a teaching visit or a communion of some sort. I'm wondering if you came across other metaphors, if you were dissatisfied with some of these.
Well, there's a very common one around psilocybin that it's a messenger, mm-hmm. and it's the heart of nature speaking to us and telling us, stop fucking things up. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people believe that. I mean, it's kind of a mystical idea, but mm-hmm. that nature speaks to us through these plant medicines. Mm-hmm. I know psilocybin's a mushroom, but often considered a plant medicine. And I wasn't comfortable with that. It just seemed a little too mystical. Like, how do you know? Mm-hmm. It is interesting that one of the very common effects of psychedelics is to shift people's perception of nature. Mm-hmm. And I had this experience in that trip in my garden where the subjectivity of plants, of other species, even of rocks, mm-hmm. was palpable to me. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about psychedelics is the universe becomes animist. Right? Everything is more alive than it was. Consciousness is more evenly spread over everything than it was. Because mm-hmm. normally we're in this subject-object duality, and we're the thinking subject, and everything else is an object. And we don't give it enough agency. Mm-hmm. And that's something I thought about a lot intellectually. I wrote a book, The Botany of Desire, which mm-hmm. is very much about, like, well, what about the plant's point of view? Mm-hmm. And they're acting on us even, I mean, that's what co-evolution is. They're acting on us even as we're acting on them. But it was an intellectual conceit when I was writing that. Here I was like, wow, that's true. Mm-hmm. And it was the most amazing thing. And these plants were returning my gaze. Mm-hmm. And they were very benign. There was nothing scary about it at all. I mean, after all, they were my plants and I had taken care of them. I was on very good terms with them, but...
It was good planning in advance.
So that's, yeah, that's a, so there is a way nature speaks to us through these things, but I didn't want to be too literal about that.
So I'm wondering about this description that we often hear about the tripping mind and then coming back to reality, this kind of idea that there is a reality that we live in and then you can go and have these trips. And as a cognitive scientist, I know that what we experience normally in our normal consciousness is nothing like reality. We're experiencing this incredible construction that their brain is constantly putting on. So, for example, we're seeing colors right now, but colors don't exist in the physical world. They're entirely a construction of the brain. And we could work right through any number of things that you think you see, you think you hear, that are not actually in physical reality. And so that creates a point of view that says that there is a normal experienced consciousness that you might have that maybe is maximized for not bumping into furniture or walking out into traffic. But then there's a great multiplicity of other consciousnesses that we could inhabit that would be maximized for other purposes or not maximized for anything, but right, you could still inhabit. And say the psilocybin consciousness is one variety, the DMT is another variety, and so on. How do you think about that multiplicity of consciousnesses as opposed to, say, a dimension, like more expanded, more narrow,
yeah,
something like that?
So, I mean, one of the things that happens on psychedelics is it helps you to kind of relativize everyday normal consciousness, mm-hmm, and you do realize it's one of several. And that's a very powerful idea in itself. And part of the excitement of this book was learning about neuroscience and that neuroscientists have this view of consciousness and to the extent to which it's constructed. Things like predictive coding. I mean, the fact is that we're predicting what we're seeing even more than we're actually, you know, we're not just literally taking in all the sense information. Mm-hmm. We're making a best guess based on experience that, you know, somebody with, you know, various characteristics is a woman.
Frizzy hair.
Yeah. And that to, in some sense, we're always hallucinating, mm-hmm, right? We're seeing something that isn't really there. It's created, but it's fact-checked pretty well. It's fact-checked more, I mean, there's an error correction feature, right? You predict something, and then the sensory information, you just get enough sensory information to say, yeah, that is a rock, or a shell, or whatever it is. Or a tree, let's mm-hmm say. I mean, that pattern, that visual pattern, that fractal pattern that is a tree, and the color, and then you correct it.
Some things are corrected physically, but some are just socially. Like with respect to color, it's only when someone
disagrees with you. Oh, yeah, we agree that, yeah, this piece of the spectrum we're going to agree to call mm-hmm red, and yeah, another culture might, mm-hmm, right, look at a slightly different piece of the spectrum. So, you know, William James said this, you know, that, you know, separated by this film are all these other kinds of consciousness, and they're not that far away. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of one of the most astonishing things, that a molecule could take one consciousness out of commission, mm-hmm, and introduce another. So I thought a lot about, well, what is this privileging of everyday normal consciousness about? And of course, it's the one that, as you suggest, is best adapted to getting through the day, you know, getting the job done, whatever we have to do to live. I mean, Aldous Huxley talked about the mind is, you know, the measly trickle of information we let into our mm-hmm minds that helps us survive, thrive, reproduce, mm-hmm, you know, all the stuff we need to do that evolution wants us to do. But if you open things wider, and he used the metaphor of the valve, right, mm-hmm, and which I think is a good metaphor, and that you open the valve much wider, and there's so much sensory information that we just edit out because it's not helpful to that project, the Darwinian project, if you want to call it that. And then there's all this internal information, too, mm-hmm, that we're also keeping a tight valve on, and that opens up, too. And it makes you realize that there's so much more to consciousness than you think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we tend to dismiss this as, well, it's a drug experience. You had all these, you know, but that doesn't answer any questions at all. Like, because your drug experience would be different than mine. Where is this material coming from? Well, it's coming from the world, and it's coming from us. One of the questions I asked one of the neuroscientists is, so predictive coding is based on this handshake, right? Between this kind of, we're putting out this idea, that's a tree, and then we're getting in some information, yeah, it is a tree, it's acting like a tree. What happens under psychedelics to that handshake? Does it get screwed up in one direction or the other? In other words, does the predictive coding get screwed up or the error correction? And he said it slides back and forth. And he said, at the same time, in some ways, your perceptions are actually more accurate. You're getting more sensory information. Mm-hmm. And I know accurate is not probably the best word to use. But in other ways, your brain is so intent on finding order and telling a story that you'll see faces in the clouds. Mm-hmm. Because a chaotic field is just asking for an interpretation. Or you'll get paranoid. Mm-hmm. All these things are happening. I have to make a narrative. The narrative's going to be really paranoid. Mm-hmm. But then there are other ways, and this is that moment in the book where I do that, the rotating mask experiment. Mm-hmm. What is that called?
The Charlie binocular. Chaplin mask. Or,
yeah. So there's this famous...
Oh, this is a lovely anecdote. This is such
this
a...
This is the most amazing experiment. I wish I had my computer here. I would show you. But there's a classic test, binocular rivalry or something. But anyway, it's that mask, mm-hmm. the dramatic mask, which is concave on one side, convex on the other, and it's on a turntable, and it's turning. And it starts out convex, as you expect it to, and then as you see the back of the mask and you see a face hollowed out, all of a sudden it'll pop out, and it'll appear to you convex, even though it hasn't really done that. Your brain insists that faces are convex, because it's never seen one that was concave. And it will impose that over the reality. So, but on a high-dose psychedelic experience, according to the neuroscientist, I was not able to duplicate this myself for reasons I'll explain, it doesn't happen. You see the back of the mask. So you're actually getting a more faithful image of reality. So it goes both ways. It's your brain is making up stuff, new stuff, wild stuff, but it's also actually taking in more sensory information. And this is particularly true in the music, I think. I mean, I heard things in music, and they've tested this, the degrees of tonality that people mm-hmm. pick up on psychedelics that they don't any other time.
So your story of why you weren't able to test this hypothesis, I loved so much, because I do a lot of work across cultures, and you have the best intentions, you have your perfectly controlled experiment, you show up with your laptop and your materials, and you're ready to measure things, and then everything goes wrong in ways that you could never have predicted. And your story was just one of the most charming ones. So what could possibly have gone wrong in your experiment?
So I wanted to test this. I'd heard this from this German scientist. And so I was having one of my guided trips, psilocybin trip, and I brought my laptop. And I thought maybe I'd take some notes. That was a joke. I was never able to take a single note during the experience. And I sort of didn't want to, too, because you wanted to really be in it. But I explained to the guide, who I call Mary in the book, what I was doing, and I really wanted to look at this image. And I showed her the image beforehand. And then as I got further and further removed from reality, I was going to try it and see if it actually happened. So a couple things happened. One was... You've all heard about set and setting, right? I mean, that one of the really interesting things about psychedelic experience is how powerfully it's influenced by your physical setting and your mindset. So your internal and external environment shape what happens to a remarkable extent. And so having brought my computer into the room and looked at this thing, which was very much, it was black and white computer-generated image, that visual idiom took over my whole trip. It was terrible. She put on a piece of music that I also didn't like. It was a New Age composer named Thierry David. And it sounded like electronic music to me. It turned out it wasn't. It was xylophone. But It was just really insipid. It was the kind of music that maybe during a, you know, if you were at a spa getting a massage would have been appropriate, but for plumbing the depths of your soul, it was like so wrong. Thierry David, I went on iTunes after, and he was thrice nominated for Best Chill Groove Album. Note, only nominated, too. He did not win. I hope he doesn't live in L.A. Anyway, so this took over, and I thought I was listening to electronic music, and I was seeing black and white. It was like a high-tech black and white video game, and I was stuck in it. Video games are not my thing at all, and I couldn't get out of it, and I had to change the music, and it was just there. And anyway, so you have to be careful what you look at before you do this. I mean, it's all feeding into this experience. So I tried it once, and nothing happened. And then at the closer to the peak of the experience, and this was for me a very high dose psilocybin experience. I opened my laptop, I managed to get it open, I hit the thing, and the thing starts turning, and then it just melted. So it was not a successful experiment. I encourage other people to try it.
It sounds like you got some very important data there.
Yeah, yeah, but not the data I was looking for.
So a few days ago, there was a ballot initiative in Colorado to decriminalize psilocybin. And I know that you had an op-ed in the New York Times. And in your op-ed, you urged caution, that we should proceed with caution. And, you know, historically, there's a lot of precedent for new ways that humans have of using or engaging their mind that other people are trepidatious about. So when Don Quixote was published, it was the first single author work of fiction, the first novel, and a lot of clerics were very, very concerned about this. They thought it was extremely dangerous for there to be fiction, and they thought that if people were exposed to fiction, they would go mad because their brains would be filled with lies, and they wouldn't be able to tell reality from unreality anymore. And of course, video games encourage the same kind of panic in people. Rock and roll music, also extremely dangerous. And so why do you find yourself among these pearl-clutching squares now?
So wait a minute. So this cautionary note, after I've like written a whole book about tripping my brains out, you're putting
you
me in the camp
all the,
of
all
the censors?
All the fun yourself and then keep it from other people.
I'm not trying to keep it from anybody. It's really about...
Maybe just this,
so I should review what this is about. So in Denver on Tuesday, much to everybody's surprise, there was this little campaign to basically tell, in the Denver County, tell the police department, make psilocybin crimes your lowest priority, okay? And much to everybody's surprise, it passed. It was a squeaker. I found out on Wednesday morning. And I didn't say it in that piece, although I did say it in an interview I did on NPR, that if I lived in Denver, I would have voted for it. Once it found its way to the ballot, I don't think anyone should go to jail for possessing, growing, using a psilocybin mushroom. So I don't have a problem with decriminalization. I have a bigger problem with legalization right now. I just don't think that we're ready. I don't think we've had the public education. I don't think we know enough, not so much about the chemical, we know a lot about the chemical, but about how best to use it, how best to regulate it in society. It's not like cannabis. It's a much more powerful experience, and it carries much greater risks. And I, you know, living in California, you know, we see what happens when you create a marketplace around a drug. I mean, yes, the sky has not fallen around cannabis, but one of the things that happens is once a market exists, capitalism gets hold of it. It's not just available, it's pushed on people, right? I mean, there is marketing, and there will be, are we ready for the marketing of psychedelics?
I think this book is a wonderful first bit of material.
Well,
You're doing advanced work for the business.
I do think there's a difference between journalism and advertising, and it's really important. So anyway, so I basically just, you know, said that. And the other reason I don't think we need to pass a lot of ballot initiatives now is that we are on a path to FDA approval of psilocybin and MDMA. This is very likely to happen in the next 5 years. It will be federal. It won't be state by state. The reason we worked on marijuana at the state level was because the federal level wasn't moving. It wasn't letting people even do research. And we had a giant problem of lots of people getting arrested for marijuana. Mass incarceration, to a large extent, had to do with marijuana crimes. We were filling jails with people who had broken marijuana laws. So there was a social justice need to deal with that in any way we could. Thwarted at the federal level, we had to deal with the state level. What exactly is the problem that the legalization of psilocybin is solving? And I'm not sure, I don't think that's really been well stated yet. There are not a lot of people being thrown in jail. Most of the people who want psilocybin can get it or grow it themselves. So I think it's a kind of like a feel-good statement to support this, but there is also a risk there, and the risk is a backlash, and a backlash that could slow down the research. So I do feel very protective of the researchers that I wrote about in the book. I think they're very courageous people. At great reputational risk, they ventured into this area that was considered very fringy when they started. They were snickered at by their colleagues. And that they have made this enormous progress demonstrating the promise of psilocybin as a medicine. And I'd hate to see another backlash as we saw in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, you know, so I'm the voice of caution.
So following up on that, one of the things that you say is that maybe we don't know enough yet about how to really use these drugs. And so as a scientist, I wonder, what's the best way to find out? And in your book, you describe this wonderful idea by Alison Gopnik that children are the R&D department for the human race, that there's this kind of expanded open consciousness that they have that you believe, and she believes, is also shared with a psychedelic state, right? And so if that is the expanded, the creative mind, the mind that will try lots and lots of different possibilities, as opposed to the scientific mind, which is very focused and narrow and laser-directed, wouldn't the most efficient way for the human race to figure out how to use psychedelics be to just give everyone all the acid they wanted, set them free, and let them discover it in this very open, expanded way?
Well, just we like would discover Timothy a lot. Leary, yeah. We would discover a lot, but I think there would be a lot of casualties, too. I mean, I think a lot of people would get hurt in that process. I mean, not a lot of people, but enough that it would give me concern. I mean, that is what's happening, right? A lot of people are using them in different ways. There is an underground in America. That is where a lot of experimentation is taking place. There is a community of, I don't know how many hundreds, or maybe just 100, of underground guides, very committed to not just treating illness with this, but helping people who want to develop themselves spiritually, deal with problems, explore their consciousness, and they are, they have somewhat similar methods to one another, but they're also experimenting in different ways. They're doing it in groups, they're doing it in different settings, so I think that work is going on, precisely that work is going on. So I'm not worried about that. It's going to happen. I mean, I think it's a really interesting cultural project to figure out new vehicles for this power, for this powerful force. And I think we'll know a lot more in a few years than we do right now. So I'm certainly not interested in halting that. I feel very protective of the underground, too. I mean, these people were incredibly generous to me and willing to work with me, even though they knew I was going to write about it. There was some legal risk in that. And that underground is growing. I mean, there are people being trained. There are classes going on right now teaching people how to be underground therapists. And luckily, they haven't gotten a lot of legal heat. So I think it's happening. I just think it's happening outside of a market economy. And for now, that seems like the right right way to go. Allison Gopnik's line about research and development is great. She says, kids are the research, the R&D department of our species. We're just production and marketing.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. So when I hear about traditional societies that use these drugs in their these very specific ways, people say, well, you always do it like this. And because I work in a lot of traditional societies, I know that there's nothing that always happens. There are always teenagers that do things not the way right. that they're supposed to. There are always people like me who don't listen to their right. elders and do things the way they want to. And so I'm wondering if you've come across any stories that enrich that narrative that isn't just like, this is the only way that you do it. But you know, in fact, you
yeah.
know, you know,
there well, there's different degrees of rigidity. Mm-hmm. So the Native American church, mm-hmm. apparently, I've never been to one of their ceremonies, they use peyote in their rituals, and it's very rigid. And you have to sit upright all night long staring at the fire or staring into someone. If you close your eyes, they come over and like open them for you. Mm-hmm. The Huichol people of Mexico, from whom the Native American church learned this, have apparently a very different kind of raucous ceremony where you can snooze if you want for a little while and get up and move around and then they have sacrifice, have a big feast, and it's much more of a party atmosphere. So there's different degrees of rigidity, but there are rules. There always are rules. You know, the ancient Greeks had the Eleusinian Mysteries, which was appears to be a psychedelic rite that everybody in Greek society participated in. One day a year, you had to keep it secret what happened, and if you used the drug outside of that context, it was a capital crime, mm-hmm. and one person was put to death for using it was called the Kikion. We don't know what was in it. But that if you took it outside of that context, you know, you couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So there are rule breakers, and they paid a price in that case. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there is there's a lot more work to be done, like looking at traditional uses and mm-hmm. seeing what's common, what's not common, and borrowing from that. I mean, there was, you know, Richard Evans Schultes did a lot of that work, the great ethnobotanist, and Mark Plotkin does it now. Mm-hmm. He wrote The Shaman's Apprentice, a really good book. And I didn't really go that deep into that world. I mean, I did explore ayahuasca a little bit, but I didn't go to South America for it. And ayahuasca is an interesting example, too. That's so syncretic at this point. It's been so westernized mm-hmm. that there are many versions of it that are being played with.
So I have a few questions here from the audience. I'll start with a really simple one. It says, psychedelics and God, real or not? In five words or less.
You know, a lot of people see God on psychedelics, and it's a religious experience for many people, and that's and in going back to these traditional cultures, that was true. When the conquistadors got to Central America, people were using mushrooms in their rites, and they called them a Tiahuatacatl, which meant flesh of the gods. Mm-hmm. So, which is what the Christian, the Catholic mass was about. You were eating the flesh of God. But this was actually a superior sacrament because you actually met God. Mm-hmm. You didn't need faith. He was there. It was there. And so that is a very common thing. I didn't see God on my trips, but many people do. I had one woman I interviewed, actually, who told me she was an atheist before her trip and an atheist after her trip, but she said, and I kissed the face of God. She used this casually, like, you know, in describing her trip. And I said, well, how can you kiss the face of God if you're an atheist? And she said, well, it was so big, and there was no other word for it, so I had to use the biggest word we had, and that was God, but I don't believe in God.
Coming back to the ineffability of that.
Yeah,
that
was exactly, yeah. She didn't have the vocabulary, and God is a word we have for this overwhelming, but there is this sense of the mysterium tremendens, that mm-hmm. people have a sense of that there's meaning in everything, and meaning for many people, a sense of imminence of meaning in the universe. People on psychedelics don't
this
often
kind of
use the word God.
The truth is revealed.
Yeah, real, oh, like, well, there's that too, the noetic quality, that what you see, what you perceive is not just an opinion or a subjective point of view, it's objectively true. It's written on a stone tablet. There was a study recently done to compare the language that people have had God encounters in life and people who have had God encounters on psychedelics. Mm-hmm. And you'd be interested in this, because the vocabularies, mm-hmm. they were the same thing, mm-hmm. remarkably, but the people on psychedelics tended not to use the word God. They use divinity and things like that, because it wasn't personified in any way. It was more atmospheric, or generalizable, abstract. And the people who have had God experiences in life do talk about God. Mm-hmm. So there are similarities and differences.
For some reason, we have a tendency to believe things that come to us from the subconscious more than things that come from our conscious mind. So, for example, if you do an experiment and you say, imagine you're deciding between two cars to buy, and you can make a list of pros and cons and check them off for the two cars, and one seems better. But then you go to sleep, and in your sleep, one of them comes to you in your dreams.
Yeah.
Which car do you buy? People will go with the one in the dreams because they feel like somehow their conscious mind is misleading them and their subconscious must be telling them something that's true, revealing
right.
a real preference that they're otherwise too afraid to see. I think that may be related to the sense of a real truth is revealed to me in this.
Yeah, that may be. That may be that it has an authority that the truth is, mm-hmm. hidden in some ways and it's exposed during this experience. But I think that noetic...
It seems unmotivated, like it just came to you, so
yeah.
it must be
the
true.
The spontaneity, yeah. it's divine inspiration, mm-hmm. right? That's mm-hmm. why we call it. It's divine inspiration, so it's mm-hmm. an inspiration, but we assume it comes from out there. I mean, the noetic sense, which is what James called this quality, this of revealed truth, is a very interesting thing because it has enormous therapeutic value. Mm-hmm. The smokers I talked to, there's a very interesting experiment at Hopkins to use a psilocybin experience to break addictions, and they've looked at smoking first. And I interviewed these people, and they would tell these stories that were, because I was saying, how could a single, you've been smoking for 30 years, and suddenly you have this one experience, and you stop, and you never smoke again. And I remember this woman telling me, she said, well, she was an Irish woman, she was about 60, and she said, so I had this amazing experience. I sprouted wings, and I flew all through European history, and I saw Shakespeare, and I died three times, and I was on the Ganges, and the smoke from my body was, and then, and I thought, God, there's so much amazing things to do and see in the world that killing yourself with cigarettes seemed really stupid. Mm-hmm. That was her profound insight. Killing yourself with cigarettes was really stupid. Now, I'm sure she'd thought that before, and I'm sure other people had told her that before, but she believed it now. It had this incredible sturdiness as an idea that allowed her to stop. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that, people talk to their shrinks all the time and yes, they know what they should do, but they never do it, this has a way of imbuing therapeutic insight mm-hmm. with authority. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of potential there that needs to be explored. There was, before high-dose psychedelic, we were talking about figuring out how to use them. In the clinical setting, there's also been a process of figuring out how to use them. And in the 50s, there was a whole other approach to LSD therapy besides the high-dose transformative experience. It was called psycholytic therapy. It was mind-loosening. Mm-hmm. And this was very big in L.A., actually. The leading practitioners were here. And often working with Hollywood celebrities, and there you would take a small, relatively small dose, like 50 micrograms of LSD, which is not a microdose, but it's not a macrodose. But it was enough you could sit in a chair and have a conversation, but your mind was loosened up, and you would bring all this material out, and apparently it was very effective, mm-hmm. and. Cary Grant famously gave this interview about how it changed his life. He had 50 sessions. And he said, he realized that he didn't need an ego, and it made him a better actor, mm-hmm. and it made him irresistible to women, he said.
Wow.
Which sounded a little egotistical.
No, well, yeah. So I have another question here from the audience. It's a very practical question. It says, I read your book. The toad sounded awful. What is your recommended route to change your mind? LSD, mushrooms, or?
Well, I think it's different for different people. In my case, I thought that psilocybin was the most effective. Mm-hmm. I could have gone further with LSD. I think it has a lot of value. But for various reasons, I never had a high-dose LSD experience. It also lasts a really long time. You know, as people often say, yeah, it was 6 amazing hours, and then it went on for 6 more hours. psilocybin doesn't do that. The toad experience that the questioner is alluding to was my most awful, terrifying trip. And the toad is a very obscure, or increasingly less obscure, psychedelic. The chemical is 5-MeO-DMT. It's not the same as DMT. It's a very different chemical, although related chemically. And it is the smoked venom of the Sonoran Desert toad, which you have to credit our species for figuring that out. you take a single puff, and so this woman from Mexico I met, she came north, and she collects the toads herself. And no toads are harmed in the making of the psychedelic. You basically gently squeeze this gland, and it squirts out this liquid that you collect on a piece of glass, and then overnight it crystallizes and becomes, it looks like brown sugar, and then you smoke it. And you have one puff, and even before you've exhaled, you were just shot out of a cannon, and it was such a disoriented experience. I mean, I had already been through an ego-dissolving experience, but not only did your ego dissolve, but everything dissolved. There was no space, there was no time, there was no matter. It was just pure storm of energy that consumed your brain and then the whole universe. It's all that there was. And I just remember, you know, holding on for dear life, and I felt like I was strapped to the outside of a rocket, and I was just shuddering. The best thing about it is it only lasts about 8 minutes, and you have this as you come down. So it was truly terrifying. I felt like I was in the middle of an explosion. As you start coming down, you reconsolidate and you feel and you realize you have a body, and there's a floor, and there's time, and there's a self, and you feel so grateful. I mean, you know, we've all felt gratitude for being alive. I felt gratitude that there was anything. Mm-hmm.
It is a marvelous thing that there is anything.
It is a marvelous thing. There could be nothing.
There could be nothing.
And I was in touch with it. Mm-hmm. And I really felt gratitude that the Big Bang actually produced matter and a planet we could live on and all that stuff. Subsequently, I was describing this trip to somebody who had a lot more experience than me. And he looked at me and he said, "You didn't take enough." But I'm not going to try it again. I don't recommend that one.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of our time here, sadly. This was really a tremendous book.
You're very kind. Thank you.
It's such a tour de force. If you haven't read it, you have to. And I hope that your next book, you'll get abducted by aliens or invent time travel or do something equally audacious. Thank you.
Well, it was a privilege of being able to talk to you about it too. And
so much
the perspective
fun.
You bring. So thank you. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you all for coming. And remember page 117, the top left corner. There's a little surprise for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.